Wow. Although the knife-wielding grandma and the hash brownies were kind of cool. That's more kind of like where I was going with the contest. All right, we are almost to the end of our teaching series in the Gospel of Mark. We are in chapter 15 tonight. Pop quiz, how many chapters are there in the Gospel of Mark? 16.5. There's always one in the crowd. 16 chapters in Mark, and what we've been doing is going through it in our Bible, in our small group studies during the week, and then come Sunday night, our sermon is from the chapter that everyone studied in the small groups during the week. That's been our pattern. So the small groups have all gone through chapter 15, and we pick up the story tonight from chapter 15. whether you know the Bible well or not, whether you've been in the Mark study or not, you probably know a lot from Mark chapter 15, because this is the chapter in which Jesus gets killed. This is the chapter of the cross, the crucifixion, and stuff like that. And it has recently been dramatized to great success in the theaters, and we celebrate it every Good Friday, Easter holiday. Most people know the elements of the story. But what we want to do is, our approach to the Gospel of Mark has been to read it as if we are reading it for the first time in the first years after it was written. That's kind of been our task, right? The Gospel of Mark was actually the first gospel written. It was actually the original Christian document. Mark was the earliest, and it's the gospel on which some of the other gospels are based, right? So Mark is as primary as you can get when it comes to, like, Christian documentation. So we want to come to this story of Jesus dying on the cross and give it an original consideration. Pretend like we've never heard it before. Somebody's just been reading the Gospel of Mark aloud to us in our village in, say, I don't know, 65 AD or something like that. We're hearing it for the first time. So that's the attitude we want to have, okay, as we consider the story for the first time. We are choosing our text tonight from the latter portion of chapter 15. So we're actually choosing the portion in which Jesus actually dies. But there's a little bit in chapter 15 that comes beforehand. And some of those elements many of you will be familiar with. Early in the chapter, Jesus is he's sentenced and he's tortured. He's beaten by Roman guards, stuff like that. He is taken before the crowd. Pilate says, do you want me to spare Jesus' life, or do you want me to spare Barabbas' life? You know, that story, and the crowd chants for Barabbas. So he's rejected. He's tortured, and then he's rejected by the crowd. He's mocked by his Roman captors. They put a robe on him. They put a crown of thorns on him. They mock him. Oh, great king. Oh, great king. Just kind of insult him and spit on him and stuff like that. And then he's led to his execution, and as was the Roman custom, he's led to execution carrying a great beam of the cross. And along the way, his strength gives out. He's been tortured all night. So he fails, even at that, sort of bites the dust. They have to bring in another fellow to help him carry the beam. So very, very pathetic scene. He's placed in a criminal lineup, right? He's executed on the cross in a line of criminals. So he's just kind of thrown up there with the riffraff. And then he's hung there for all to see. It would have been the Roman custom to nail him to the cross, wrists and the feet. He would have been hung naked, completely naked, his flesh having been torn to shreds by whips, and in his case, the beating of Roman people. So he gets hung up there for all to see, dying, naked, bleeding, mocked, rejected, the whole nine yards. Right. So that's the kind of day that it's been, a very, very lowly day. Now we pick up the story beginning in on verse 33, it's on the back of your programs, and it's also going to be shown behind me. We're getting right close to the end. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. Elijah being a famous prophet from Jewish history. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the Younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. So Jesus has been roughly treated. He's been abandoned by his followers, rejected by his people, sentenced by the Romans, and then hung up on this cross by the Romans. And he's just as low as you can go. He's being treated like garbage. And then you get an eclipse over the land. Evidently, as the darkness came over the whole land, the sun kind of went away and went night. Eclipses are kind of spooky. It sounds like this was like total. So very, very impressive. And evidently, it begins to make people feel a little, what's going on here? This is getting kind of weird. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cries out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which would seem to indicate that this guy has just had enough, right? He's been beaten up. He's hanging there with a bunch of nails in him. And he's saying, gosh, even God has rejected me. Everybody else has, now God has. But if you were in the know, and many people around him were religious people of the Jewish faith in that day, you would know that this is a line from what was a very, very famous psalm. It was a psalm of messianic prophecy. It was a psalm that many thought predicted the coming of the Messiah, which was this hero figure in the Jewish religion, this Messiah. What Jesus was doing was quoting the first line of this prophecy. And so any educated person there, any educated Jewish person would say, oh my gosh, the prophecy. How did that go again? What's he trying to tell us? And I just lost my place. From Psalm 22. Here's how it went. Some of it, anyway. my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer by night, and I'm not silent. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the praise of Israel, and you are fathers put their trust. But I am a worm and not a man. In other words, I've been debased. I've been set low. Scorned by men and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Yet you brought me out of the womb, and you made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me. Many bulls surround me. Strong bulls encircle me. Roaring lions tearing their prey. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint, and my heart has turned to wax. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth, which is why the guy went and ran and got vinegar, right? He knew the whole psalm. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. This was written hundreds of years before the Romans invented crucifixion. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. They cast lots for my clothing, which they actually did after Jesus expired. Not a bad prediction for being written many centuries before. So you can imagine the scene. Eclipse, and then Jesus is up there, and he quotes a little bit of Psalm 22. And then the religious people that were there run through Psalm 22 in their heads and say, wait a minute, doesn't that say that this guy has pierced hands and feet? Whoops. Maybe this is not going a good way for us. Maybe we have overlooked something here. Right? And they begin to talk about Elijah, because it was prophesied that this famous guy, Elijah, would return to earth. He ascended to heaven in a chariot of fire in Old Testament days. It was prophesied Elijah will come back before the Messiah. Maybe this guy is doing that right now. He's calling Elijah to save him, because obviously he needs some saving. That was sort of the thinking that was going on. He's calling Elijah, so they give him some vinegar, kind of cut the cotton mouth to see if he's going to say anything else. He probably wasn't speaking very clearly at that point. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, which strikes me as funny. What if Elijah did come? It would not go well for those people on the ground, right? Like, you know, let's see if the commandos come in. And then with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. This too is curious, if you're keeping score. When people died on the cross, they didn't die from the piercing. They died from suffocation. Because after you hung up there, eventually your diaphragm would become paralyzed. And so for Jesus to shout at the moment he died, it tells you his diaphragm is not paralyzed. Jesus chose the moment of his death. That's what that says, physiologically speaking. The Roman centurion realizes this, right? It said when the Roman centurion heard his cry and saw him die, he was like, okay, that wasn't normal. There's something very, very unusual happening here. This guy is of God. This guy is the Son of God. The Roman centurion gets it. The religious people at the cross are still probing and testing, even as Jesus is expiring. The temple, the curtain in the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The curtain was the thing that separated the holy presence of God from humankind. So for the curtain to be torn in two, that's as if God were saying, all right, there's no longer any separation between us. It's done. For the curtain to be ripped from top to bottom was miraculous because the curtain was extremely tall and extremely thick, like, you know, 4 to 8 inches thick. So for it to be torn like that was quite remarkable. God himself would have had to do it. That's why it's in here. That's why he mentions it. Fascinating stuff. They're thinking Elijah's going to come, but Jesus dies instead. And then he adds this detail. Some women were watching from a distance. Mary Magdalene, Mother Mary. That's who that is. Salome. All of his male followers had abandoned him, which is incredibly humiliating. All of his friends betrayed him. His people rejected him, which is why he's up there on the cross in the first place. He's just hanging alone, naked and alone and dying. And the only people that are there are women, which in that culture would have been like an insult. At your death, you'll be encircled by no one but women. I will not. You know, it was very humiliating because women were not looked upon well, right, in that culture. And then the author says even more. He says, in Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. That means during his ministry, he was funded by a bunch of women. You know how embarrassing that detail would have been? Why is Mark putting this here? It's like Mark saying, he's been a mama's boy all along. And then at the end, only the girls are with him. It's just incredibly humiliating. In that day and age, in that culture. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. Only women saw this. Quite something for Mark to include. At the end of all of this mockery, even if this guy were to come back to life, the way Mark writes it, he would have been embarrassed. You know? So this is your revolutionary movement. You get mocked, you get insulted, you can't even carry your own cross up to the hill, and then you die, and you got no followers except women. How embarrassing. How embarrassing is that? Whenever we look at a text, I ask the same question, what about the text bothers you? You know, this is a story that a lot of you have heard, but what really bothers you about this text? And there's a lot in it to be bothered by. But one thing that really jumps out at me, if I'm thinking, I'm hearing this for the first time, somebody has just come to my village, read the gospel to me, when I get to this part, I've been kind of following the story of Jesus and his revolution all along, and then I get to this part and have this incredibly humiliating failure, death, you know, and my movement has boiled down to only women. I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, okay, why did somebody write this down? Because if you're trying to promote Jesus to me, you've just almost guaranteed I will reject him. Right? In that culture, that's how it would have come across. This is so embarrassing for a man to die like this that you'd have to wonder, are you reading this because you want me to become a follower of Jesus or because you want me to stay away from Jesus? That's kind of how it would be. Everybody understand? Just kind of nod knowingly, even if you haven't been listening. Why in the world would Mark have included this in the account? You hear the story and you think to yourself, why would I want to pay attention any longer? Why are you even telling me the story? If it gets better, you better tell me fast. If you know anything about the theological implications of Jesus' death on the cross, you know, propitiatory sacrifice and all of that stuff, just forget it right now. And just pretend like you've just heard the story for the first time and just think for yourself for the rest of the time. You're hearing the story. What's going through your head? Just think for yourself. You've just heard it for the first time. What's going through your head? Get any immediate questions pop up for you guys? Maybe from some of your small groups. Was there a point? Right. I mean, it's mystery enough that that an advocate, that this guy Mark, would include this bit in the story because you'd want to whitewash it. You know, it's like, you know, George Washington probably had an adulterous affair. They don't teach that in elementary school. You whitewash part of that, right? This would be part of Jesus' story that you would want to whitewash. Is there a point? Because it's there, there must be a point to you telling me this. What in the world is it? Why would you do something like this? Why would a guy die like this? What's the point? Yeah, any other questions? Why didn't Jesus save himself? All through the story, Jesus had been doing miracles and even resurrected a girl from the dead. Jesus was quite a capable guy. He's trying to prove some point, evidently. And what in the world could that be? One way or another, I think, you know, those are the sorts of questions that you're going to ask. I've broken it down into some smaller questions. Just for consideration, if you're mulling it over, pretend like you're listening for the first time. These are some of the questions that would have popped into my head. What does this story say about the Jesus movement? If this story is true, what does it say about the Jesus movement that the Gospel of Mark is supposedly trying to advance in the world? What does it say? Well, it says, you know, a few obvious things. One, it says that if you're interested in the Jesus movement, you should know that the Jesus movement is shameless. It's shameless because you've just described a very shameful death to your leader. So you must be shameless. These sorts of things must not bother you. Humiliation must not bother you if you're a follower of Jesus. It sort of suggests that. Any self-respecting religion would have edited out the last half of chapter 15. If you're thinking about the Jesus movement, you would probably conclude, having heard this story, that it's weak. This is your mighty leader, subjected to all of this. You guys kind of must be into weakness, right? This whole passivity thing. Right? That's probably what you would conclude. And here's the biggie. If, as the Roman declares and has been declared previously in the Gospel of Mark, if this guy Jesus is the Son of God, right? If God is all about Jesus, if Jesus is all about God, if God figures in, this is a very, very strange sort of God. Right? If this guy is the Son of God, what self-respecting God would allow this to happen and why? This must be a very weird God. So, question number two. What does this scene tell you about the God of the Jesus movement? What does it tell you? Not who we think, or we would have thought God was like, right? Somebody, it's weird, right? Surprising.
Don't trust him,
right? Because his followers do not end well, right? That's probably going through your head. Right? Saying, this God is, you know, Zeus is good. I like Zeus. Thunderbolts and all. What else? Yeah. Good. Keep it going. Humble. And I think that's probably the key word. You know, is this God loving? What's that? Incredibly. We're trained to think that, right? Our God is loving. But is there anything in this story that tells you that God is particularly loving? Not yet, right? If it's true that God is loving, we haven't gotten that far. What it tells you is that God is willing to be humiliated. This is really a story about the humiliation of God, right? If Jesus is really of God, the one thing this story tells you is that this is a very, very humble being. That's what the text screams out. And it's sort of a revolution in the idea of God that I don't think the world has yet recovered from. That God is actually humble. That God has been humiliated. That's something that's very, very hard to get your brain around. This guy is not afraid of being humiliated. That's what the cross is about. That's what this whole day was about. You could not get any lower than Jesus had gotten. Gods are supposed to be mighty, proud. They demand obedience and worship. And this God borders on embarrassment. And that's very unsettling. And that's right at the heart of the Jesus movement. God and embarrassment kind of go together. Fascinating. This is just really, really weird. If you're hearing this story for the first time, you at least are interested because it's been so unusual. Why would a God subject himself to this kind of humiliation? Presumably there's some purpose in it. Presumably he has to do this in order for the Jesus movement to go forward. We'll try to talk about that later. We'll try to talk about it more in 2 weeks from now, actually. But backing up a little bit, let me ask you this question. How would one go about following a humble God? Think about that for a minute. We talk about God being mighty, and I think we have some intuitive appreciation for what it's like to follow a mighty God. You follow a mighty God carefully and confidently, right? So you don't want to make him mad, but if he's on your side, it's really cool, right? So we have some appreciation for what it's like to follow a mighty God. And we talk about God being loving, and we have some intuitive appreciation for that. A loving God is probably like into second chances, things like peace, you know, we appreciate that. But what does it mean to follow a God who's been humiliated? What does that mean? So disturbing. And I know it's a strong way to say it, but I think it gets to the heart of the matter. What does following a really, really humble God require of us? What do you think?
Humility.
Humility, right. Yeah. Right, and not just humility, but extreme lowliness, right? Because presumably God is supposed to be higher than the rest of us. Well, if Jesus is the Son of God, and this is sort of one of the defining moments of Christianity, you know, Jesus being humiliated this day, how low do we have to be to make sure that he's higher? You know, so this sort of extreme lowliness in some fashion, which makes me very unsettled. That's not a good selling point for my faith. Here's the standard, you must be lower. Come on! It'll be fun! We'll have a good time. Let's go find some Romans. That's hard. The other thing, this is just me talking. All right, but follow me. If you decided that you're going to follow a humiliated God like this, I think it speaks to why you would follow a God like this. I mean, you might follow a God who's mighty for reasons of strength. You might follow a God who's loving for reasons of, you know, forgiveness, peace, and all that good stuff. You follow a humble God like this, I think you'd have to do it because you liked him. Practically speaking, I think that's what it means. Right? I mean, why else would you follow somebody who's been really humiliated except that you kind of dig what it says about his character? You kind of like him. You kind of like to hang around the guy. And it's as if the centerpiece of Christianity, Jesus sort of dying this terrible death on the cross, being humiliated, rejected, mocked, and all that stuff, it's like he's saying, okay, we've done some mighty miracles. I've sent a lot of cool things to the poor. I've been very accepting and welcoming. But here's my invitation. If you want to follow me, if you want to follow this God, just kind of, you know, like me. Do it because you have a lot of affection for me. Sort of makes the invitation that. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? If humiliation is at the core, what kind of invitation is that? and lets us an invitation to say, I'm kind of likable. I'm kind of safe. It changes the way I look at God, anyway. That's just for your consideration. It could just mean my weirdness, but there you go. It's still hard for me to think of God in those terms, you know, God who is humiliated, because, you know, I'm quite practiced on approaching God in reverence, right? I'm not so practiced hanging out with God because I just really like him. He's safe, he's humble, he's small, you know. No Christians ever built a cathedral out of like, right? They did it all out of reverence. You know, nobody ever got a doctorate in humility, in humiliation at seminary. You know, it involves me to, like, change my precepts a little bit. Anyway, what does it mean for the quality of your life if you're going to follow a humble God? Just a couple more questions to end with and get your brain hurting. What does humility get you? If this is a quality that Jesus is advocating, I would say that humility gets you freedom more than anything else. I'm just going to say this so that you continue to think of it in the next couple of weeks. Shame is when you're afraid to be seen. And humility is when you're willing to disappear. Very different. And humility to me feels like freedom. Nothing about you matters, right? Do I look goofy? I don't care. Did I do something stupid? You know, I don't care. Did I eat hash brownies in Pakistan? It's no big deal, right? I got no ego. I'll tell that story. It's got to be no big deal to your mom, Justin. I'm going to call her. I'm going to tell her that that you shared it. Because, you know, if you're humiliated, if you really kind of live there, right, you don't care what people think of you, right? I think it has a certain healthful quality that Jesus has been preaching all along when it comes to thinking about the requirements of following Christ. You know, we're asking the question in a couple of weeks, what is required of you to be a follower of Jesus, according to the Gospel of Mark? Well, if humility fits in there somewhere, I think it gets you to a place where Jesus would want you to be in terms of religion and stuff like that. So Jesus has been beaten up on religious rules for the entirety of the Gospel of Mark, right? Right? Right, so here's how humility fit in. Let's say, I'm going to ask you, what do I need to do to follow Jesus? Now somebody give me a really religious answer. What do I need to do to follow Jesus?
Get washed in the blood.
I don't even know what that means. No, something that's, you know, give me a rule. Give me some kind of religious rule. Give money. Go to church all the time. I can't do that. I'm just a loser. I can't do that. That's kind of where humility takes you, right? It makes you look at rules in a different way. Instead of like, oh, I can do that. I'm going to work really, really hard. It's like, oh, gosh, I'm such a loser. I'm not sure I can meet that standard. All right, let's try something else. Let's try temptation. All right, one of you is going to tempt me into some grievous sin. Pick something besides hash brownies. So go ahead. Somebody tempt me with something.
Strip bar.
I heard two things and they mixed in my brain very dangerously. What?
Strip bar.
Go to a strip bar to strip or to watch strippers? Just say, go watch strippers.
Okay.
Go watch strippers. All right, you're going to tell me to go watch strippers. I don't deserve that. Right, that's how humility kind of protects you. Right? So it kind of protects you against religious rules and kind of protects you against temptation. Also protects me from the wrath of my wife. Yes. Good point. Good point, Eddie. All right, so just be thinking about that, because we're going to talk about what's required to become a follower of Jesus in a couple of weeks. It's humility and discipleship. If humility is important, how can you go about being more humble than you are? How can you go about being perfectly humble like me? All right. How to be humiliated. Something, you know, to think about, if it's actually a value. Okay, number one, confess your failings often. I try to do that, try to confess them often, because they're so obvious anyway, right? One story I tell a lot in here is how I failed miserably at my chosen profession, right? What did I want to be?
A teacher.
Professor, and how did that go?
Not
thank you for reminding me of that painful chapter of my life. But you confess your failings a lot, right? And if you're, that sort of, it's a way to practice being humiliated. Practice looking funny. Don't say it. But this is what I mean. If you're really interested in sort of fostering humility in your life, I had a friend who one day was a young woman who decided she was a little too aware of her appearance. And so she got a colorful Band-Aid, and she put it across her nose. And then for days, she just lived like that. Right? And walking into any setting, she was aware that people were looking at her nose and were afraid to ask. Right? There's a lot of tension. But that was her way to practice being humiliated. It's just kind of, you know, a small thing. But to practice looking funny. Maybe some of you could think of some equally creative ideas if it came to it. I've shared a story in here about an opportunity I had to look bad in church. I was like in this big church that had a liturgical dance team. You know where this is going, right? The captain of the dance team called me one afternoon and said, Jordan, you're very musical. Why don't you come and dance because we need an extra partner, an extra couple. You and you know Sonia could do it. Sonia was making her living doing musicals and stuff like that. And I said, no. And then I hung up the phone. And it's right after I hung up the phone, God spoke in an uncharacteristically clear manner. And he said, why won't you dance for me? And I said, oh, God, no. So I danced in front of 1,000 people. And it went so well, I had to do it twice. Really good. I wore a colorful little vest. And I did it, and I never have to do it again because I have proven myself humble. Thank you very much. A lot of humiliation happens. It can be fun. We had a lot of humiliating stories out of bachelor parties, yes? But nobody's willing to talk about it. All right. My bachelor party, I was living in the most dangerous ghetto in America, and my friends took me to the far side of the ghetto, stripped me to my underwear, and then released me to run through the center streets of town, and they were following behind me with headlights and honking. I got one up on them. I bolted. I leapt a barbed wire fence and ran through the swamplands to get home. The swamplands where nobody ever went because people got killed there. The secret was that they were so scary, nobody ever went there. So I was completely alone running in my underwear to get home. I was seen neither by locals nor by police, which was my goal. My stepbrother had a bachelor party in which our friends got together and stripped him naked and then duct taped him to a telephone pole at the busiest intersection in town. How about that? That's so cool. I love that story. Very, very humiliating, right? No dignity in that whatsoever, right? Does it remind you of anything that happened to, say, God? Being stripped naked and strapped to a pole for everybody to see. And it's mind-bending. Right? That, you know, my stepbrother's bachelor party and that sort of abject humiliation that, you know, people are just trying to make him embarrassed, and then, you know, you treat God the same way. It's, you kind of choke on it when you think about it. Fascinating. There should be any parallels to strange situations like that. Okay, just food for you to think about. This is a very, very weird guy, this Jesus. And if he's connected to God, it's a very, very strange God that would humiliate himself to prove a point. There's only one more chapter in Mark, and either the point's going to become clear, or it's going to be a very curious thing. So tune in. Next week we're going to do the healing service, and the week after that we're going to finish the puppy. And I'm going to ask you the question, what's required to follow Jesus? What have you learned through the Gospel of Mark? I trust that so far it has not been what you expected, that this is the weirdest religion ever concocted, and this guy, Jesus, is the most surprising figure you ever care to meet. One way in which we practice humility in church is through worship. That's really what worship is. The word worship that's used in the Bible literally means to bow down. It means to lower yourself in front of a superior being, a superior person. And that's what we do when we sing songs, when we raise hands, when we kneel, stuff like that. I'd like to invite you all to stand. We're going to end doing some prayer ministry time.